Hello everyone, my name is Francis Donald and I'd like to welcome you to the seventh session in an ongoing series of webinars on sacred number and geometry. Gosh, I can't believe we're all the way up to our seventh session, but that's the case. It's also going to be the last one this year because the third Sunday of December is December 21st, which is the first day of the Moria Federation school year. And it's the solstice, and there will be other broadcasts occurring. So we won't meet again until January 18th, but I will alert you at the end of the webinar about that once more. Feel free to ask questions or make comments anytime during the webinar. Just raise your little digital hand there. It's a button up off the side of your control panel. Or use the text box in your control panel, and BL will call on you. We're assisted today by many silent helpers, but BL will be calling on you when you would like to participate. So don't be shy. Just jump right in anytime. I may not be able to get you right away, but BL will interrupt me in my presentation, and we'll get you as soon as we can. So last month we explored the Vesica Pisces, which we discovered is the portal that leads from oneness through the door of two into the many. We then focused on the equilateral triangle, the first figure to emerge from the Vesica Pisces, and the sacred trinity that it represents in a few of its many forms. I quoted Iamblichus, who stated, "Three is the first to make actual the potentialities of the monad." And this really gets to the essence of threeness. If you only retain one thing about the triad, trinity, threeness, remember that it is the expression of unity in manifestation, and thus the first complete number. This is its most important attribute. HBB says, when the one becomes two, the threefold appears, and the three are one. Okay, last month we began to trace the cosmic origins of the number three. We looked at the advent of the third aspect of deity, intelligent activity, which HBB describes as the exhalation of the great breath. I'd like to begin today's webinar by taking a look at Letters on Occult Meditation. In Letter 7, Dwal Kool suggests that certain beings characterized by the same number have significant correspondences. Here's his list for the number 3. So let's right away get into having somebody out there read this list. Could we get a volunteer to read the list for us? Anybody? BL, yes. Do we have a volunteer?
Yes. Good. We do. Go ahead, Guadalupe.
Good morning.
Good morning, Guadalupe.
Yes, the threefold solar system, the threefold evolving Shiva, the three aspects of the Logos, the threefold monad, the spiritual triad, the ego, the threefold personality, the three worlds of human evolution, the three persons of deity.
Thank you, Guadalupe, and thanks for attending today. He goes on to say that this correlation, which is, you know, that which the threefold have in common, expresses itself in terms of, quote, color when dealing with form, in terms of sound when dealing with the life side, and in terms of vitality when dealing with intelligence or the activity aspect. Even the correlation between these threefold existences, color, sound, and vitality is threefold. So what does this mean? Well, it suggests that the relationship between, for example, a threefold solar system and a threefold personality, even though they're incredibly distant from each other in consciousness, are nonetheless characterized by some similarity in the root quality of the sound they either express or are able to attune to. And for the adept who is able to attune to the life expression, he's able to perceive this quality of sound that is emanated by any one of these threefold beings. And that the integrated forms of each threefold being expresses some variation of the same color, which for three is green. So two very different levels of greenness are expressed through both a personality and a solar system. Now, this seems to be a real head puzzler, you know, when you think, you know, what we know about green as this color that represents the surface of an object, for instance. When in fact, green is, and all colors, represent a paradigm of vibrational existence. And it's that these various threefold entities are sharing, right? And the color represents the nature of the form, the paradigm of the form. It ties these threefold existences together at the level of form, whereas sound ties them together at in the first aspect, or in that essential life quality. The third point of correlation, here's the color, by the way. The third point of correlation, the vitality of the intelligence or activity aspect, it's especially difficult for us to comprehend, because we tend to think of vitality as a singular quality. We either have more of it or less of it. But decay seems to be suggesting that in addition to the degree of the strength of our vitality, vitality has variable qualities depending on the numbers associated with it. So possibly the quality of vitality is that special abstract something that predisposes each ray type to express itself in its own particular way. Of course, a treatise could be written about any one of these categories. What I'm emphasizing here is that threeness itself, irrespective of that which it is conditioning, has a unique quality and potency, which expresses itself through a related sound, vitality, and color. We might even hypothesize that the connective tissue afforded by threeness is the most influential of all the characteristics of these threefold beings. This expression is a great cosmic principle, because you have to remember threeness, which is the third aspect, permeates all manifestation, right? From the third cosmic logos down to the atom of substance. One might even say that a significant part of the evolution of indwelling jiva just means, by the way, that fragment of light that is the life force in any form, right? So the evolution of the indwelling jiva is a steadily strengthening identification with the nature of threeness. So we have these examples of how three manifests, but what is this potency of threeness? Well, we're told that we'll find out at the third initiation, but in the meantime, we're given a few clues. The power of threeness is inextricably bound to Fohat, which you may remember is the conscious, intelligent, electrical force that demonstrates through all manifestation. FOHOT, we are told, is triple in its nature. In fact, it is the motive force of the third aspect of deity, intelligent activity, a fact revealed through its many names. Among these names is the light that guides through the triple caves of darkness, which we can assume refers to the three worlds of human evolution, the lower quaternary. Possibly the reason FOHOT is able to guide us through these three worlds is because it itself is threefold and thus has an affinity with the vibratory nature of that which it is guiding us through. We find a clue to the identity behind the guidance of FOHOT in another of its names, which is the revelation of the mother. This is a somewhat surprising name until you remember that we're not talking about the mother the mother aspect, but rather the revelation of the mother. So the mother is invariably associated with water. Thus, FOHOT is also called the boat of mystery, which plows the ocean. A specific reference to the astral plane, whereon, you know, preparation for the second initiation takes place. So, you know, we can assume that this boat of mystery is plowing the ocean in order to find a safe shore on the other side, and is plowing it for our benefit. FOHOT's also called the clue to the energy uniting fire and water, which seems to refer to the mental plane and FOHOT's integrative functionality. In fact, this name suggests that FOHOT is essential and certainly instrumental to our evolutionary process, since it is through the union of fire and water that we can pass into the fiery upper subplanes of the mental plane, wherein our soul has its being. And once we get there, we are given the key to the divine storehouse, which is yet another name for FOHOT. The storehouse itself, we can hypothesize, is the causal body. But the term key gives us a further clue as to the nature of FOHOT. For in this context, a key could be described as a means by which to align ourselves with some reality. In this case, the divine storehouse, which would otherwise remain closed to us. We might even say that FOHOT is that which we invoke through meditation, right speech, and actions, and is thus the agent of becoming. And the metaphor for that is to be able to turn the key, right, by refining our own nature. I think at some point DK says that when your vibratory rate comes to a point to where it's in harmony with that which lies on the other side of the door, the door just opens of its own accord, right? So if in this function of key, it suggests that FOHOT is the agent of that balancing of the vibration. It burns away the dross and incubates substance of the higher subplanes, thus aligning us with our own higher selves. As a result, the quality of our color becomes more luminous, the nature of our vitality more refined, and the note we sound is of a higher octave, thus allowing us to transform our natures from being identified primarily as the threefold personality to the threefold soul aspect, and then from there to the threefold monad. But nonetheless, we are in essence of the same nature. Okay, to translate this into the language of sacred number, let's look again at the Vescapices. We have the father aspect, which reflects itself into the form or mother aspect. Fohat, which is the revelation of the mother, works through, we have hypothesized at least, the square root of 3. And reflect for a moment on the nature of a square root. Since it is a transrational force, a kind of seed potency, doesn't it make sense that the transformative agent of those beings interrelated through their threefold nature, among them the threefold personality, the threefold ego, and the threefold monad, would be affected by the square root of 3 or the root of 3? If we allow this hypothesis to stand, and we've been working with it now for a few webinars, this chart, which was published in the Theosophists around the turn of the last century, and which illustrates the evolution of the jiva, or the indwelling life, could also be said to describe the effect of this fohatic square root of 3, here represented by the central line. And we can use the lines on either side of this this chart to possibly to reveal aspects of the Vesicapices. This is the nature of sacred geometry. You find its correlations and you use that additional information to enlighten oneself as to the nature of the geometric figure. Okay, moving along. The feminine nature of the number 3 is revealed through the third arcanum of the Tarot, called the Empress. It's interesting to note, in view of the Fohatic name, the key to the divine storehouse, that the letter associated with the Empress is Daleth, which means door, but also signifies storage of that which is useful. So there's a strong correlation with the idea of the divine storehouse there. The Empress is associated with Venus, which DK tells us is the Earth's primary and is responsible for the coming in of mind via the Lords of Flame during the third root race. The direction associated with the Empress is the east, where, of course, Venus rises with the sun. The Kabbalists associate Daleth and thus the Empress with luminous intelligence, which is a pretty clear reference to the third aspect of divinity, which DK calls active intelligence. In ancient Egypt, Venus was Hathor, which means, translated in the Egyptian, means mansion of Horus. Okay, this is a form. This is of the form nature, hence the feminine goddess, and is pretty clearly another reference, since Horus represents the solar principle, or the soul level, to the divine storehouse, or causal body. DK tells us that the heart of the sun, Venus, and Earth form a triangle that brought about the creation of our causal bodies. This is primarily because, you know, Venus is our primary, which means that it stands in a relationship to the Earth as the soul stands to each of us as individuals. Okay, the color associated with the number 3 is green, or rather indigo green, since all colors issue from indigo, just as all the rays are in this solar system emanations of the second ray of love wisdom. DK tells us that the synthetic ray, which is indigo, and the activity ray, which is green, are at this stage the only two of which you can be absolutely assured. One is the goal of endeavor, and the other is the foundation color of nature. We're told it is on the third subplane of Atma that the green of activity predominates. You can see it there, third one down. And that this atmic green, which is almost certainly not the green we're looking at here, is strongly related to the orange of the middle plane, of the mental plane, which you can see two more subplanes down. And you'll find often that subplanes correlate by odd or even rather than by the next plane beneath or above them. DK goes on to say that the red, the green, and the indigo of these high levels are, to all intents and purposes, new colors of a beauty and translucence inconceivable. So when visualizing these, or I should say attempting to visualize, imagining these highest planes and rays, we should keep in mind that the colors we know, that of the physical plane, have to do with the form side, whereas the forces and qualities which these colors veil have to do with the life aspect. Green, which DK calls the robe in which the earth is clad, stimulates and heals and is especially effective in cases of inflammation and fever. So green is the natural color of the form side, at least in this solar system, and is therefore of a naturally healing nature to us. That's of course why the vegetable kingdom is predominantly green in its color. You know, we tend to view color as a secondary, even superficial aspect of an object, as in a blue car or green shirt. But these teachings help us to realize that colors are, in essence, great determining forces. That field of energy whose exoteric covering is the color green determines the activity of the natural world. It's not an effect. Green is not an effect, but rather the determining agent. Or as DK says, green is the basis of the activity of nature. The force that substands the green that we see animates the green devas of the vegetable kingdom. These devas are the embodiment of the energy of green. This is a somewhat new idea for many of us, that there is a great determining intent and force in each of these colors, and that there are whole deva kingdoms that are formulated or have come into being just to carry out the intent of that force, which on some level is probably a great entity. I haven't seen this said anywhere, but it's, you know, it's possible that these colors themselves are great beings. If you remember from our discussion on the number two, that indigo is the goal of our endeavor. And as I said when we were discussing this, it's not that, you know, once we reach the goal of our endeavor, we're going to be seeing a lot of indigo stuff around us. It's something inherent in the determining energy of indigo that is our goal. It's a rather extraordinary teaching and something not often mentioned. Okay, enough of me reading for a while. Could we get a volunteer to read this passage? It's from A Treatise on Cosmic Fire, and I think it'll help give us some insight into the esoteric nature of green. BL, do we have a volunteer?
Not yet. Come on, folks.
Someone like to read this about the green devas?
Please go ahead, Keith.
All right. The green devas of the vegetable kingdom exist in two divisions. They are of high development and will be contacted principally along the lines of magnetization. The greater devas of this order preside over the magnetic spots of the earth, guard the solitude of the forests, reserve intact spaces on the planet which are required to be violet. They defend them from molestation, and with the violet devas are at this time working definitely, though temporarily, under the Lord Maitreya.
Thank you, Keith. Good to hear you. Thanks for joining us today. And it's the first time I've been able to talk to you, so welcome to the faculty of the Moria Federation. We're all just thrilled to have you on board. Okay.
Thanks.
Yeah, you're welcome. Would anybody, you know, we've gone here a while, covered some topics. Does anybody have any questions or comments, musings, great revelations, imaginings? This Deva that's shown here is by Jeffrey Hodson, who was a clairvoyant and drew a series of these that he published some time ago. I'm not sure when that came out, but he they're quick watercolors that were meant to capture the essence. It's another way of looking at painting on the spot. If you have clairvoyant vision, then this would be the way you would be able to express yourself. Okay, if there's no comments at this point, we'll move along into the impact of three in music. Has a tremendous effect on music. Symphonies and sonatas, concertos are usually, though not always, written in three movements. There are three clefs, which together span the full range of notes played or sung. Notes one-third of an octave apart are naturally harmonic. This interval is called a major third. Sounds like this. Bum, bum. Bum, bum, that's a major third. And it looks like that. And it's also true, this division into three parts, the octave division into three parts, is also true of the color wheel. All the colors that fall within any third of a color wheel are naturally harmonious. So if you would just imagine this wheel and just choose any third of it, doesn't matter where, and you'll see if you look at the two extreme sides that there's a certain natural harmony that follows within a bracket of one-third of the color wheel. The ancient wisdom teachings tell us that sound and color are intrinsically related. I was once under the tutelage of a spiritual teacher who claimed to see flashes of colored lights when he heard musical notes. And I've heard this from other sorts too, other sources as well. In astrology, as many of you know, the trine, which encompasses one-third of the zodiacal wheel, is considered to be a beneficial aspect. It represents an easy connection between the two points that are connected by the trine. And a grand trine is considered to be a great boon. So we could conclude that there's something about threeness that is inherently harmonious and favorable, because we can see from these examples that it transcends any particular discipline. I'm sure Harry Potter is very pleased with his grand trine. But let's get back to music for a moment. The third is also unique in Western music for its ability to determine the fundamental mood or emotional quality of a piece. The major third gives us an uplifting, all is right with the world emotional quality, whereas the minor third, and the major third is bum, 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 and the minor third is bum, bum, ba-da. It gives us a sad or melancholy quality. Now, there's other chord intervals that can affect emotions and the sense of the mood, but the major and minor third is by far the strongest of these, and it tends to set the overall emotional quality of the musical piece. So a musical chord can be seen as a metaphor. Here's the full chord with the root third and the fifth, okay, 12 half-step intervals. So we can be it can also be seen as a metaphor for the three aspects of the human being. The root note relates to the first aspect and the monad, which here is, you can see depicted right at the point where the sun shows itself just above the horizon of the earth. And there's almost like these noumenal wings with this globe above it. And that represents the monadic form. And then the fifth of the chord represents the solar aspect, which is the main focus of this painting, which I did 2 or 3 years ago to represent Aries. It's called Incarnation. And the impulse to incarnate is the point of this. And then the third aspect is represented by the musical third, and is represented by the man at the bottom of the image. And that can express itself as either a major, in a major or minor quality. Okay, the number of half steps between the three notes of a major chord is respectively 4, 3, and 5. Which are also the measured increments that distinguish a Pythagorean triangle, right? Thus, the Pythagorean triangle represents one full octave. You can see here, if you count the matchsticks, you would find that there are 12 steps broken into 3, 4, and 5 measures per side. So this is one way we work with sacred geometry, is to be aware of these correlations. We now know about the Pythagorean triangle that it represents the major chord. Well, that really tells us something about it, about this triangle, and gives us a hint as to why it has such importance. And I want to interject a footnote here. Since music is uniquely equipped to reveal the emotional aspect of a geometrical figure, it can be most instructive when possible, and it's not always possible, to translate the geometrical proportions of a figure into its equivalent musical structure. It can be nothing reveals the emotional nature as clearly as music. So though not Pythagorean by angle, the 3, 4, 5 triangle can also be used in astrology. When set on a zodiacal wheel, this triangle forms a trine, a square, and a quincunx, or inconjunct. Here you see two of interrelated 3, 4, 5 triangles. Okay, now for you astrologers, considering that these are the elements of a major chord, right, I would hypothesize that there is a synthetic significance to the appearance of a 3, 4, 5 triangle in a chart that just possibly may be more significant than just the separate meanings of the individual elements. So rather than just reading that there's a square and a trine and an inconjunct, one might look at all three points of aspect and treat them as a whole. I don't know anyone who is really practicing this. It's just a concept, and it seems to be important based on the nature of 3, 4, 5, which we'll look at in a minute, and the fact that it represents a major chord. Okay, so does this Pythagorean sequence of 3, 4, 5 seem familiar? Remember the hierarchy of beings described in stanza 4 of the Secret Doctrine, whose numbers were pi, 3, 1, 4, 1, 5? Blavatsky gives us a further scintillating hint into the deep symbolism of these numbers. Could we get someone to read this passage, please? I would appreciate it. Someone step forward and read about this. And when you get to the two symbols, the symbol and the Hebrew words, you just read, just pass it and read what stands beyond them. Biel, do we have any volunteers?
Not yet. Everybody's shy.
Oh, yeah, we have a bunch of shy people, huh? Okay. Somebody out there?
Go ahead, Michael.
Okay. The reader will understand why, while the transhimalayan chakra has inscribed within it, triangle, first line, cube, second line, and a pentacle with a knot in the center. The Kabbalistic circle of the Elohim reveals when the letters of the word Ahim or Elohim are numerically read, the famous numerals 3, 1, 4, 1, 5, the astronomical pi number, or the hidden meaning of Dhyana Buddhas, of the Gebers, the Geborim, the Kaberi, and the Elohim, all signifying great men, titans, heavenly men, and on earth, the giants.
Thank you, Michael. Appreciate that. So, let's do a quick tally. We have pi, which is 1, 3, 1, 4, 1, 5. We have the major chord, whose intervals are 3, 4, and 5. We have the Pythagorean triangle, whose side links are 3, 4, and 5. We have the square, the trine, and the quincunx, which form a figure in astrology, governed by the numbers 3, 4, and 5. We have a mysterious transhimalayan chakra that has inscribed within it a triangle, line, cube, line, and pentacle. And we have the Hebrew word for Elohim, which is numerically 3, 1, 4, 1, 5. So I think this gives us enough evidence to forward the hypothesis that these phenomena are related and, in fact, are descriptions of one synthetic reality. And here's this. In sacred geometry, it's important to use each revelation of a potential connection to gain understanding of a synthetic whole that you're attempting to understand. So, for instance, when we look at a major chord, we hear a major chord, we automatically have information about the nature of 3, 4, 5. And as we look at each one of these manifestations of this phenomena, we get a little more insight into whatever that great reality is that is being alluded to through these various disciplines. Okay, the most extraordinary quality of the Pythagorean triangle is that a squared plus b squared equals c squared. I'm sure you are all familiar with this, even if, like me, you are not mathematicians. So as you can see here, that if you add the sides, the square of the sides a and b, you have 9 and 16, which is 25, which is the square of 5. So that's the nature of this. So what does this mean? It's interesting to consider this concept philosophically. I thought about this for a while, and this is what I came up with. And I would love it if anyone has insight into the, you know, the philosophical meaning of this connection. The formula seems to represent the fact that in the manifested universe, there is no pure form or pure spirit. We talk about form and spirit, but it's all relative. For all, when in manifestation, is imbued with consciousness. Thus, consciousness is equal, quote unquote, to the sum of spirit and matter, because it imbues all spirit and matter. But I'll be the first to acknowledge that there's a great mystery hidden in the proportions of this triangle, which was probably part of the Greek mystery school. You know, I'm sure that, as always happens, these secrets remain esoteric to this day. But even though they remain hidden to us, the fact that the numbers 3, 4, and 5 are present indicates the profundity of the mystery. Okay, there are many manifestations of threeness in temple construction, but perhaps the most remarkable is the triplicity of the outer court, the inner court, and that area of a temple called the Holy of Holies. Let's look at two temples from ancient times whose design incorporates this particular triplicity. Architecturally, the simplest of the two is Solomon's Temple, made up of a great or outer court, you can see it there to the right, an upper or inner court there in the middle, and a Holy of Holies, which contained behind a veil or curtain the Ark of the Covenant. The proportions of this temple were said to mirror those of a human being reclining, as shown in this illustration. One moved from the outer court to the inner court by passing between two great pillars. Boaz, which stood to one's left, was at least symbolically black and represented the form side. Joachim, on the other hand, was to the right and represented a spirit, and was, at least in masonry, they're often literally colored black and white. In this model, they're not. Okay. In 1 Kings, verse 739, we're told that there were five lavers, or hand-washing basins, on either side of the temple, just past these two pillars, which, by the way, they represent the great pairs of opposites, right? As you can see in this illustration, the placement and number of these lavers, you see those five, it looks like an outspread hand, and they were placed right above the reclining figure's hands. So these 10 lavers possibly represented the fingers of the hand, which is normally the way we think of purifying ourselves, is through hand washing. D.K.A. tells us in Glamour World Problem that when the first pair of opposites, symbolized by the black and white pillars of Boaz and Joachim, are brought into synthesis, a reorientation occurs toward the truer values and to the world of reality. Here's these pillars. It's interesting to note that the combination of the two symbols on these pillars, the upward and downward pointing triangles, gives us the symbolism of Judaism, which is, in this context, an equilibrating middle path, which, and guess what lies in the middle between the two pillars, the doorway into the inner temple. D.K. goes on to say, it is this conflict between the pairs of opposites, when successfully waged, which lands the man upon the path of purification. A purification symbolized by the 10 lavers just beyond the two pillars. Only after such purification is it possible to pass through the folding doors of Solomon's temple into the inner courtyard called simply the holy place. This inner court corresponded to the torso of a human being. You can see here that all of the chakras, except for the head chakras, are embraced by the holy place, the temple of the holy place. The holy place is symbolized the reorientation of one's expression from the lower to higher chakras, called by DK the swerving of the bull in mid-career. And of course, this results in a reversal on the wheel of incarnation. Of course, the swerving of the bull is—it's a clear reference to to Taurus and to the reconsecration of one's desire nature to the soul, which is, of course, symbolized by light. And so you have the opened eye, the central eye, the eye of light, which is a symbol in Taurus. Only after this repolarization was access to the stairway at the far end of the temple available. This stairway corresponds to the throat center and led up to the veiled entrance of the Holy of Holies. So you can see there, it's even marked that there's a correspondence with this stairway. This is an actual photo of the original. No, not really. All of this is reconstructions. The Temple of Solomon is long gone. And we have some descriptions in the Bible of what the Ark of the Covenant looked like, especially the two opposing angels on the top. But as to how they were formed is anyone's guess. So the use of the stairway or incline leading up to the most sacred part of the temple is certainly not unique to Solomon's temple. We find it in the Great Pyramid, where the Grand Gallery leads up to the King's Chamber. This is, you're looking up here. There can be a kind of the illusion that you're looking down, but you're not. You're actually looking, you're going up a stairway here. And this Grand Gallery ends in the King's Chamber. This is a map of the Grand Gallery, those series of parallel lines. An extraordinary place. If you ever get a chance, I strongly recommend it. And then you have to bend low to actually step into the King's Chamber. I think it's definitely an indication of the needed humility to pass into the Holy of Holies. Okay, back to Solomon. Across the entrance to the Holy of Holies was a veil or curtain, protecting the unready and unworthy from the great potency of the Ark of the Covenant. Here's the Indiana Jones version. And here's a gilded bas-relief from a cathedral. I think it's in Germany. It's called the Ach. A-U-C-H, Auch Cathedral. This whole idea of a veil veiling the Holy of Holies reminds me of stories about Pythagoras, who was said to teach from behind a veil because the vibration was just too strong for his students to directly bear. So when he became overshadowed by whatever extraordinary being, overshadowed Pythagoras, then he would close this curtain and teach from behind it to protect his students. The Holy of Holies corresponds to the head of the human being and was accessed only by the master of the temple, who was very possibly, in fact, a master of compassion or a master of wisdom, and only by him once a year. It was built as a perfect cube and had within it curious element called the mercy seat, a gilded plank suspended just above the ark, which acted as a focal point for some holy presence to inhabit the temple. Now, this idea of the perfect cube, it's the most primordial representation of the physical plane, and would therefore act magically to allow a spiritual being to gain a quality of manifestation or physicalization, though I'm sure it wasn't literally physical. When that being was present, it was said that a cloud would enshroud the Holy of Holies as a warning that no one was to enter. Extraordinary myth slash history concerning this great temple, which I have no doubt existed. Okay. The massive temple complex at Luxor in Egypt was also created using an outer and an inner court and a Holy of Holies, though the temple has many additional rooms and areas. It's just a huge complex. But it was also constructed using three distinct separate axes. For centuries, it was assumed that these axes were random manifestation of this centuries-long growth of the temple. But the greatest esotericist Egyptologist of all time, a Frenchman named R.A. Schwaller de Lubitsch, pictured here, discovered these axes under ancient paving stones chiseled in the subfloor of the Holy of Holies. Since Egyptian temple construction always began from the most holy area and progressed outwards from that, Schwaller de Lubitsch realized that these axes were intended from the very beginning and had been followed by builders for over 1,000 years. This inspired him to meticulously measure the entire temple. It basically took him his whole life. He was decades doing this. And he soon realized that the proportions of the temple carried within them a great canon of laws relating to the creation, spiritual development, and destiny of humankind. He called his findings the sacred science and dubbed the temple at Luxor the Temple of Man, which is also the name of his massive two-volume set on the subject. So if you're interested in this canon that describes the creation and spiritual development of humankind, I can strongly recommend these works. I've read into them a ways, and I find them that he's an extraordinary writer. He's clearly an initiate of some stature, and I think incarnated to break the old hypnosis of the way Egyptology was being perceived up till his time. So, though it was constructed over at least 1,000 years, every architectural element within the temple, even those added by the Greeks and Romans, follows one or more of these three axes. In fact, though it is rigorously geometrical, there is scarcely a right angle to be found in the thousands upon thousands of angles that make up this complex. This triple subtle shift in angle would seem to be related to the triple constitution of a human being. If you look closely, you can see in this map the outline of a person overlaid on the temple itself. The personality-related outer court at the bottom there, which is the way you enter the temple, has its very distinct axis, right? But that axis gives way to a subtly new angle as one moves into the soul-animated inner court and its connecting passage. The axis shifts even more subtly, almost imperceptibly, as one steps into the closed complex that houses the Holy of Holies, which you see is related to the head centers, just as the Temple of Solomon was. Okay, changing gears here. The unique potency of threeness is nowhere better illustrated than through DK's science of triangles. He tells us, let's get a reader for this. Would someone would like to read this brief passage that describes the science of triangles?
No hand yet. Any volunteers? Yes. Go ahead, please, Iris.
This science of triangles concerns the beneficence of deity, and that through the intricate combinations of cosmic, systemic, and planetary triangles, the purposes of God are working out. Those purposes are motivated by love.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
You're welcome.
But why triangles rather than, say, squares? What is the intrinsic energy that is so particular to the triangle? The answer seems to be that at this time and in this solar system, will, love, and intelligent activity form a synthetic whole, the three in one, and thus participation in a triangular configuration infuses each participant with the synthetic energy of oneness. Okay, I'd like to, if we could, have another reader to read this description of what can be found in these triangles.
Okay, Nancy's raised her hand a couple times. So Nancy, you want to go ahead?
Yes, if you can hear me. My
we can, beautifully.
Okay, I don't have a headset, so.
Oh, okay. Well, you sound great. No problem.
Okay. All triangles will be regarded as expressing a major conditioning energy producing manifestation. This corresponds to the monad aspect. B, a secondary qualifying energy producing consciousness. This corresponds to the ego or soul aspect. C, a lesser expression of force producing tangibility. This corresponds to the personality aspect.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay, we're told that only the man who's responsive to these three focal points of energy can understand the interplay. You know, every time I read only the man, I become uncomfortable, you know, having grown up in a different time in a different world. But you must recognize that when that Dualkal is always speaking in the generic when he uses these male terms. Only, in fact, can the man apprehend the underlying truth whose two head centers and his heart center form a triangle of flowing energies. So clearly, this is a pretty high level of consciousness that allows one to recognize the nature of these, or really apprehend these, the full import of these triangles. Especially the first aspect, because for the most part we're dealing with apprehending the third and second aspects of deity. So conditioning all the lesser triangles affecting our solar system is the triangle formed by the Great Bear, the Pleiades, and Sirius, each expressive of one of the three aspects of deities, right? This great triangle manifests through three subsidiary triangles. So each one of these great beings, the Great Bear, the Pleiades, and Sirius, manifests through its own triangle. Because we're working with the number three and the third aspect, today we're going to take a closer look at the at the third aspect, which is this corner of the triangle represented by the Pleiades. So representing the third aspect of deity, that of active intelligence, there is a triangle formed by the Pleiades, Cancer, and Venus. This illustration was just meant to show how the three secondary triangles that are representative of the great triangle of the Great Bear, the Pleiades, and Sirius. So we're going to take a look at the Pleiades triangle. So the Pleiades, which is an aggregate of seven energies, influences the form side and focuses itself through humanity. In fact, it's responsible for the nature of the form aspect, which is also the aspect of intelligent activity, right? In fact, HPP tells us that each of the Pleiades overshadowed one of the Atlantean subraces, and were thus called at that time the Atlantides. That's kind of an extraordinary fact. HPB tells us that electricity comes to us from the Pleiades. This is the triple nature of Fohat, which enables intelligent activity to express itself in our solar system. It's interesting to note that Fohat is referred to in the stanzas of Zahn as the seven brothers, and that the Pleiades are often called the seven sisters, as well as the wives of the seven rishis of the Great Bear. These seven Fohatic brothers rule each of the subplanes of our cosmic physical plane. Okay, are you with me here? We've got seven brothers that come to us from the Pleiades, and rule each brother, one of the subplanes of the cosmic physical plane, meaning the physical, the astral, the mental, the buddhic, the atmic, the monadic, and the adi planes. Here's the ruler of the astral subplane. You know, I'm just seeing if you're awake. Here's the three eldest brothers rule not the top three subplanes, as one might suppose, but rather the first, third, and fifth subplanes, hence their coloration of red, green, and orange. If you remember, there's a great affinity between the green and the orange. I know for some of you this is a bit technical, but bear with me, and I think you'll come to get some sense of this Fohatic principle. Together, these seven brothers are the revelation of the mother, which is one of the names of Fohat, and most certainly refers to the Pleiades, who are also called the feminine opposite of Brahma. As a footnote, note the natural affinity between the numbers 3 and 7, both expressions, at least from one perspective, of the form side of nature. D.K. says in reference to Fohat that always the three will be seen, and later the seven, who eventually merge into the primary three. In fact, three groups of seven form one of the most primary triangles affecting our solar system, the seven rishis of the Great Bear, the seven planetary logi of our solar system, and the seven Pleiades. Three sevens add to 21, which numerologically reduce again to three, revealing their essential threefold nature. Okay, the second member of the triangle. Remember, we're discussing the secondary triangle, which is the third aspect through the Pleiades. The second member of that triangle, and we're stepping down as we come, is Cancer, which blends together in outer manifestation the triple qualities of life, consciousness, and manifested duality represented by the first three signs of the zodiac. So, you know, Cancer participates in both fourness, because it's the fourth sign, and it's physical, and so you have the cube of space, and it's its four-squareness. But it also participates in threeness through the fact that it is that it represents the third aspect in the sense of the form side, because it's the gateway into incarnation and manifestation. Cancer represents the light within the form, that is the diffused light of substance itself, what's called the dark light of matter. It is the light awaiting the stimulation coming from the soul light. So this is a painting I did a couple years back that represents Cancer, and you can see the threefold nature. The third aspect, or the personality, represented by the figure standing on the steps of the temple, and it can be seen as either facing inwards or facing outwards, though indeed it's facing inwards. And the second aspect, the soul aspect, which is stands at the very center of the temple, and therefore is self-realized, is in the darker blue. And then the little tiny figure, which seems to be at the throat, heart center area, is actually a third figure standing on the hillside way in the distance and represents the monadic aspect. And notice that if you look at the very top, you'll see the sign Neptune, then on the far side, on the lintel there, you'll see this the astrological sign for Saturn, because this represents the two gates, the one into incarnation. So in one sense, this temple is the entire temple of life through all the signs, all the six axes that represent the 12 signs. And what we're looking at here is the axes representing Cancer, right? Because the far gate, as we know, is through Capricorn, which Saturn rules, and leads to the mountaintops, which are in the background, those two kind of glowing circles that are hidden by the structure of the temple represent the hierarchy on the right, the lower mountaintop, and then the Shambhala on the left there. Okay, let's see here. Okay, the third member of the triangle. So we've gone from the Pleiades through Cancer and now to Venus. And remember, this was represented by the third tarot arcanum and is associated with the number green, I mean the color green. It's really through Venus that our solar system is able to participate in this triangle that we're discussing. And it brings to us the energy of active intelligence. And it's through the tertiary triangle of Venus, Jupiter, and Earth that this influence actually reaches our planet. Or as DK puts it, the heavenly men of Venus and Jupiter are magnetically linked with the heavenly man of our scheme. But not all triangles represent cosmic or interplanetary connections. Can we get a reader for this this next section here? This has to do with the etheric body of our planet. Someone like to read this, please?
Volunteers? Jocelyn, would you like to do the honors?
Okay.
Thank you.
The inner web of light, which is called the etheric body of the planet, is essentially a web of triangles. And when the evolutionary process is completed, it will have been organized. At present, a pattern of squares is the major construction of the web, but this is slowly changing as the divine plan works out. The etheric webs of the sacred planets are largely triangles, whilst that of the sun is that of interlaced circles. The effort on Earth today, as seen by the planetary logos, is to bring about a transformation of the web of the planet and thus slowly change the existing squares into triangles.
Thank you, Jocelyn.
This is a
very important statement for the sacred geometer, because it tells us that geometric figures are intrinsically linked with some specific level of consciousness. And the circle, the triangle, and the square represent progressive forms of that consciousness. Remember, in China, they read from right to left, so the circle comes first. We've heard this from, you know, other sources on sacred geometry, but now it's coming to us directly from DK, that there is a specific relationship between these specific geometric figures and states of consciousness. He's telling us very specifically that a non-sacred planet manifests through in its etheric body through the square, that sacred planets manifest through the triangle, and that our solar logos, at least, manifest through a series of interconnected circles. It's really it's one of those precious teachings that come to us through Dhual Kul. So we can infer that the etheric webs of human beings are also influenced by this geometry, right? Well, finally, we can say that as individuals within our group work and as a planet, we aspire toward the consciousness of the triangle. I want to repeat something that I've emphasized before. Geometric forms do not represent a state of consciousness, but rather carry the quality of that consciousness within their very structure. They are not metaphors or mental bookmarks to remind us of an idea, but are themselves imbued with the force of the ideas they express. They stand in a causal relationship to language. That's what makes their study so important. So it is that the four triangles that make up the Great Pyramid can affect the consciousness of anyone who stands within its walls. You may have noticed that although this is our seventh webinar together and we're only up to the number three, most of the topics covered have served only as brief introductions to the material. This is particularly true of the science of the triangles, to which DK devotes the latter, I don't know, about a third of esoteric astrology. Most of you probably know about a program sponsored by Lucha's Trust called Triangles. I could do no better than to quote this description from luchastrust.org. Actually, I'd like one of you to quote it. If you could read this passage, it comes from the luchastrust.org website. Can we have a reader, please?
Come on, don't be shy. Here we go. Go ahead, Trudy.
A triangle is a group of three people who link each day in thought for a few minutes of creative meditation. They need not necessarily live in the same locality, and many international triangles exist. Each day, members sit quietly for a few minutes and link mentally with other members of their triangle or triangles. They invoke the energies of light and goodwill, visualizing these energies as circulating through the three focal points of each triangle and pouring out through the network of triangles surrounding the planet. At the same time, they repeat the great invocation, thus helping to form a channel for the downpouring of light and love into the consciousness of humanity.
Thank you. Appreciate that. So the link between this work, the triangle work, sponsored by Lucha's Trust, and the transformation of the etheric web of ourselves and thus of our planet into a series of interlocking triangles, it seems like an obvious link, doesn't it? And it may be, since the concept was introduced to Alice Bailey by Dwal Kool, it may be very much more directly connected than we think. It's literally forming etheric links, and very possibly this directly affects the etheric body of our planet. I strongly urge anyone interested to check out luchastrust.org. I'm sure that 90% of you are aware of this website, but if one of you happen not to be, browse around on this website. But triangles is listed under the tab entitled Service Activities. So if you're inspired to do this, I recommend it. Okay, now let's take a look at the significance of the number 3 in the Kabbalistic Tree of Life. The name of the third Sephiroth is Bina, which means understanding or intelligence, and like the third aspect in theosophy, is associated with the color green. Bina is likened to a palace of mirrors that reflects the pure point of light of Chokmah, which is the second aspect and the second Sephiroth, increasing it in an infinite variety of ways. It's described as the womb, which gives shape to the Spirit of God. So it's really through Bina that all the Sephiroth beneath this triad come into form. Excuse me. Bina is also associated with the Greek goddess of the harvest, Demeter. Demeter means mother, so we have mother goddess or mother earth, thus her connection with the harvest. She is the goddess of the Eleusinian mysteries, whose secrets were shared only among its female initiates. Her daughter was Persephone, and it was Demeter who traveled to the underworld to retrieve her. This act was a central theme in the Eleusinian mysteries, and almost certainly has at its core the redemption of humanity from the underworld that theosophy calls the lower quaternary, the physical, astral, and lower mental planes. Okay, changing gears again, the spinal cord is profoundly influenced by threeness, for it houses the threefold thread, or what's called the way of approach. These threads are called the Ida, or Ida, I'm not sure, the Pingala, and the Santa Maria. No, the Shishumna path. That's the central path. Once the Antahkarana is constructed, which is the bridge linking us with our soul, first of all, integrating the personality and then linking to the soul. Once that bridge, the Antahkarana, is constructed, the monad is able to affect the personality and call forth, by means of the root chakra, the three fires, electric fire, solar fire, and fire by friction. These three fires and the three channels or threads are directly related to the father, mother, and solar or sun aspect of divinity. The Kundalini fire is actually a combination of these three fires. So once we have, again, we have this demonstration of the three being elements of the intent, the intention of the one. Okay, we've already touched on the beneficent influence of the trine. Let's look at some of the other ways that threeness impacts astrology. Of the three crosses, the mutable cross is most closely associated with the number three. By the way, the very fact that there are three crosses is another demonstration of the three in one, for together they represent the influences that represent the entire path of return. Okay, the mutable cross relates to the form nature and is dominant in its influence during the eons-long process of personality integration. It leads the disciple through the initial stages of purification. Remember the lavers in the Temple of Solomon? You pass through the pairs of opposites represented by the great pillars, which means conscious, integrated personality. Then move into the process of purification, still basically ruled by the mutable cross, and to the threshold of the burning ground, where the influence of the fixed cross begins to dominate. That's what's represented here. DK tells us, well, actually, let's get a reader for this section. This describes the nature of the mutable cross. Can we get a reader, please?
Any volunteers? Here we go. Go ahead, Nancy, please.
Upon the mutable cross, the crucified man sees naught of the picture. He suffers, agonizes, desires, strives, is the apparent victim of circumstances, and is distinguished by a veiled vision and inchoate longings. These gradually take shape until he reaches the stage of acquiescence and aspiration. Then he finds himself upon the fixed cross and begins to grasp the whole of the purpose of experience upon the mutable cross, and to realize that there is a hierarchical purpose which can only be grasped by the man who is willing to be crucified upon that cross.
Thank you, Nancy. So it's not only the fixed cross on which we are crucified. The difference is that on the mutable cross, the crucifixion occurs as a result of being in the halls of ignorance, right? Even somewhat into the halls of learning, because it tends to follow us, doesn't it? Even after we gain some level of consciousness. I'd like to conclude our consideration of the three crosses with this astonishing statement by the Tibetan from the Rays and Initiations. Now we've been looking at the three crosses since our consideration of the number one, where we looked at the cardinal cross, and then again with the fixed during the number two. So Scott, are you with us? If Scott is in attendance, can you determine that, DL?
He is with us, but he's there twice, but it says offline. So
he's there twice, but it says offline.
Yeah, he's having difficulties. He's been coming and going.
Oh, I see. Okay. Okay, it's going to take a big breath, but would someone like to read this for us, please? This is in... basically, it's in celebration of the three crosses and of the sense of their sequence and how extraordinarily high their influence reaches. So do we have a volunteer?
Not yet.
How about Orest? Are you with us today?
No, he's not, but maybe Leah. Yes.
Okay.
Thank you, Leah. Appreciate it.
Having transcended the world of phenomena and established an unbroken contact with the monad via the Antikarana, the initiate renounces the mutable cross of existence in the three worlds, the world of appearances. And after a period of time, he transfers from that cross onto the fixed cross, which is set up in the world of meaning, where he has steadily learnt to dwell. This covers the period of the first three initiations. Now, being liberated through renunciation, he needs no longer to undergo the tests, trials, and difficulties which crucifixion upon the fixed cross inevitably entails. He can now take his place upon the cardinal cross with all its cosmic implications and opportunities which are then conferred. This, as far as the individual is concerned, is necessarily symbolic and figurative in its teaching. As far as the heavenly man is concerned, however, the application is not symbolic. It is far more factual. From the angle of the Supreme Masters on Sirius, our planetary logos, Sanat Kumara, is still on the fixed cross. He mounted the mutable cross in the first solar system. The fixed cross still holds him in this solar system, fixed in his place. In the next solar system, he will transfer himself to the cardinal cross, and from thence return to that high place from whence he came. You can see, therefore, why I emphasize the fact that these three crosses are simply symbols of experience in relation to the individual disciple.
Thanks so much, Leah. Okay, with no further comment, because we could easily spend much more time than we have on this reading, we'll move on to the two astrological signs that are strongly influenced by the third ray. Through the Earth, rulership of the Earth, Sagittarius is esoterically ruled by this ray. In combination with the influence of the mutable cross, which governs the sign, the third ray enables the one-pointed disciple to equip himself for initiation. Through Saturn, Capricorn is ruled both exoterically and esoterically by the third ray. Two teachings, when correlated, give us insight into the meaning of Saturn's rulership of Capricorn. First, Saturn is the planetary equivalent of the dweller on the threshold. This figure is a Buddhist representation of Saturn in its dweller aspect. Secondly, Capricorn admits the soul into conscious participation in the life of the hierarchy. That's what's meant by the higher gate, the second gate out of the human experience. It's participation in the life of the hierarchy. But first, the dweller must be repolarized. Notice I didn't say snuck by or destroyed. It has to, in fact, be repolarized because it is essentially the personality. And this shift doesn't take place until the disciple has completed the process of personality integration in Sagittarius, as well as the other signs, and achieves some degree of soul contact. Then the process of shifting the dweller from its positive polarity, controlled by the sign Leo, to a negative passive polarity in Sagittarius takes place in preparation for final initiation in Capricorn. DK tells us discipleship is significant of maturity, and it is with mature development that the dweller is met. So one must create some level of soul identification. There must be an other within one's own personality in order to recognize that personality as the dweller. If one is just completely immersed in the personality nature, then the dweller cannot be met because, in a sense, one is unconsciously that dweller. Part of this maturity comes through a realization that karma is a form of opportunity. The opportunity through conscious awareness to face up to one's past and thus more intelligently prepare for the future. I think this guy still has to learn this lesson. Part of this maturity comes through a realization, DK tells us that Saturn is one of the most potent of the four lords of karma, and thus, from the perspective of the disciple, ever provides the opportunity to balance the karmic scale. So if you have strong connection with Saturn, either through the fact that you're in the midst of a Saturn return, which I know at least a couple of listeners here are today, you know, at age 28 or 56 in that area, or if Saturn is has strongly aspected in your chart, instead of looking at it as a harbinger of difficulty, realize that you are being, as a disciple, you're being provided with a tremendous opportunity to balance the karmic scales. It's interesting to note in this regard that Libra, the sign of balance, has Saturn as its hierarchical ruler. As a lord of karma, Saturn is associated with a lawgiver. In fact, Moses and Mount Sinai are externalizations of the influence of Saturn and Capricorn, especially when we consider the nature of the Ten Commandments, which, after all, were designed to help mankind avoid the burden of negative karma. So let's talk a little bit about the third ray in our last remaining moments. We're actually out of time. I'm going to go over a little bit today because I'd like to finish up with the number three, but we'll be out of here inside of 10 minutes. So DK tells us that Saturn, Mars, and our Earth constitute, in a curious esoteric manner, the personality of a stupendous ray life whose energy is that of the third ray. He goes on to say that the mental body of this life expresses itself through the medium of the planet Saturn. The astral body expresses itself through the planet Mars, and the physical body expresses itself through the planet Earth. So you have this being who is conditioned by the third ray, or is the third ray life itself, who is actually manifesting in this planetary triangle, through this planetary triangle. This tabulation gives us some additional insight into the relationship between Sagittarius and Capricorn. For Sag is ruled by both the Earth and Mars, and Capricorn is ruled by Saturn. Thus we have the physical and astral components of this great third ray life expressing itself through Sagittarius, and its mental body expressing itself through Saturn. This relationship between Sagittarius and Capricorn helps us to understand the fact that there is a passage between these two signs called the Little Gate, which leads to the Great Gate of release in Capricorn. Both gates made possible by the influence of the third ray. Okay, we'll end our discussion of the number three and this webinar by taking a look at two very special geometric figures, the Borromean rings and the triquetra. The Borromean rings have an ingenious but quite simple physical attribute that reveals the essence of threeness. At first glance, these rings seem to be interlaced, but if you take a closer look, you'll discover that no two of these rings are interlocked. The blue ring completely overlays the red, the red ring completely overlays the green, and the green ring completely overlays the blue. So, though no single ring is uniquely responsible for holding the rings together, if you were to cut any one of these rings, the whole would separate into its component parts. This symbol demonstrates how unity manifests through Trinity, which is just another word for tri-unity. As I mentioned before, the potency of sacred geometry comes from the fact that it stands in a causal relationship to the three worlds of human endeavor, and stands far beyond the realm of the metaphor and just a symbol or an analogy of language. So, what is an example of this Borromean law in our lives? You can apply this in so many ways. It's quite ingenious in that way. I'm going to do it by going through the rays. For a first ray person, a duality is resolved into oneness through the third ring of personal will on the lower levels and through identification on the higher. for a person influenced by the second ray, duality is resolved into unity through the third ring of affection and sentiment at the level of the personality, and by the great unifying potency of love emanating from our souls on higher levels of consciousness. Indeed, it's through the soul that the monad is able to link or influence the personality. The active unifying principle, or the third ring, of each subsequent ray is indicated by the ray names themselves, each ray type being a method for the demonstration of the unity inherent in the Trinity. So, for instance, if we go to the fourth ray, the resolving of duality into unity is made through harmony and the recognition of beauty, etc. So if you know the ray names or would like to look them up, you can see how this correlation goes right down through ray 7. So in threeness, we have the essence of the manifested world. And this Borromean symbol indicates that. Finally, we have the triquetra, which I've been using all the way through this webinar, which is made up of three half circles and three vesica pisces, right? In the same way that the vesica pisces moved us from two-ness to three-ness, right, the vesica pisces with two full circles, the triquetra, this figure, moves us from three-ness to four-ness. But this fourth principle, which stands at the center of the figure, it's that down-pointing triangular figure at the center, is actually the one in three. This is demonstrated by a triquetra of colored light whose center portion returns us to white, which represents unity in the world of color. Okay, we'll end today's webinar and our discussion of the number three with what is, in my opinion, one of the more beautiful of all the crop circles, a triquetra interwoven with three concentric circles. I hope you've enjoyed today's webinar. If you'd like to stay ahead of the curve, you can read the chapters on the number four in both The Key to the Universe by Harriet and Homer Curtis and the chapters on the number four in A Beginner's Guide to Constructing the Universe by Michael Schneider. Also, for those of you who like to draw, take a look at Workbook 1 on pages 25 through 31 in Sacred Geometry by Robert Lawler. And this will introduce you to the concept of the square root of 2, which is related to the square and the number 4. I'd like to close, as we did last time, by using the Great Invocation with DK's commentary. If you'd like, you can use this geometric figure to aid in your visualization. If you were with us a couple of webinars ago, we developed this extensively. If you weren't, the four points in the center of the vesica pisces represent light on the right, love on top, will on the left, and humanity on the bottom. So the down-pointing white arrow is invocative of the three aspects that are in this great invocation. In a letter to a disciple, DK focuses on the first three verses of the invocation. In fact, he doesn't even mention the last verse. So let's begin by chanting Om. DK says, one, Visualize the world situation as best you can, and in terms of your major world interest and with what knowledge of world affairs you may possess, see the mass of men everywhere glowing with a dim light, and here and there points of a brighter light where members of the new group of world servers and men of spiritual intention and of loving hearts are working for their fellow men. Pardon that interruption. Then visualize through the creative imagination the vivid light of the hierarchy streaming towards humanity and slowly merging with the light which is already in men. Then say the first stanza of the invocation. From the point of light within the mind of God, let light stream forth into the minds of men. Let light descend on earth. Then ponder upon the reappearance of the Christ. Realize that no matter by what name he may be called in the many worlds of religions, world religions, he is still the same great identity. Reflect and speculate upon the possible results of his appearance. Then say the second stanza of the invocation. From the point of love within the heart of God, let love stream forth into the hearts of men. May Christ return to earth. Endeavor to concentrate your fixed attention, intention. Endeavor to concentrate your fixed intention to serve and to spread love in your surroundings. And realize that insofar as you can do these things, you are attempting to blend your personal will with the divine will. Then say stanza three of the invocation. From the center where the will of God is known, let purpose guide the little wills of men, the purpose which the masters know and serve. Consider practically what you can do in the coming week to further the preparations for the coming of the Christ. Then sound the Om three times, dedicating the threefold personality to the work of preparation. Om. Om. DK doesn't complete the great invocation in these instructions, but let's go ahead and finish it. From the center which we call the race of men, let the plan of love and light work out, and may it seal the door where evil dwells. Let light and love and power restore the plan on earth. Om. For those of you who are interested in this particular passage, these instructions are on pages 227 and 228 of Discipleship in the New Age, Volume 2. Okay, that's it for today. Don't forget to throw a couple of bucks at the Moray Federation, which you can do on morayfederation.com to help pay for this account, this GoToMeeting account. And thanks to Brett, these webinars are available on makara.us. And finally, keep spreading the word about this webinar. Stop strangers on the street. Call random phone numbers. No, but I would appreciate it if you would tell your friends, spread the word any way you can. It'd be great to fill the webinar up. So thank you for attending, and I'll see you next time, which won't be until January 18th, 2015, which I mentioned before. And those of you involved with the Moray Federation, make sure to tune in for the webinar that will be kicking off the school year on December 21st. And I'll see you in 2015. Okay, bye for now.